This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Heather P., Jonathan C., Andrea M., Catherine, Les, and Joelle. Thank you so much, guys. For even more true crime reviews and discussion, hop on The Bladder Presents tipster line at patreon.com/bladderpresents. And now, the episode.
Well, as long as I'm there, all our enemies are happy.
Like, if they put somebody else,
somebody didn't come from jail,
they're going to be a big problem, a real big problem.
And a happy new episode to you in jail. All right, I shouldn't joke about the carceral state, but I'm not the only one putting an inappropriately cheery spin on things, as Netflix's Happy Jail is determined, at least initially, to do the same. Later, we go from the Philippines to upstate New York as guards and prisoners try to get justice from a state that would kill them to make a point in 2001's Ghosts of Attica. Is this podcast a thriller? Listen and find out. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 111. If you thought a week off would cure the terrible wordplay, I have some very hard news for you. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, where we try to find the true crime that's worth your time. My guest is once again my partner in true crime, the engine that drives the Best Evidence newsletter, Eve Beatty. Hey, Eve.
Hello.
Before we begin, a little pod business. As you remember, we took last week off to move the pod over to the Audio Boom servers. If you're listening to this, it worked. Unless you're listening to this on the web, because you can't see new apps in your podcast app, so try deleting and resubscribing. The pod should have a new logo when it comes back. Apologies for any interruption of service. And when I do get some sponsors rolling through, thanks to Audio Boom, please give those advertisers a click and use those sponsor codes if you can. It helps keep the lights on here at Bladder HQ. And in case you're only a listener and you don't follow The Bladder on social, which, P.S., you can do, it's at Bladder Presents everywhere. I mean, not TikTok, because I'm old, but, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Insta. Mark Blankenship reviewed Cynthia Rowe's 2017 crime noir. Should I be continuing to try to get this expression to catch on? Anyway, it's called The Spider and the Fly, and both Mark and the book will, I think, get you thinking about the roles that we give ourselves as consumers of this genre. And you can find that on the homepage at the-blotter.com. Enough of my blathering. Let's hear a most wanted sound cue and then some more of my blathering. Today's most wanted topic is the documentary series Happy Jail. Here's the case file, and the suggested Google result is succinct, so let's go with that. Quote, the Philippine jail known for a viral Michael Jackson dance video comes under the management of a former convict, sparking controversy and criticism. End quote. I thought this was a film when I suggested it. Like I said, it's actually a series. It's only 5 episodes. They're about half hour, 35 minutes each, so you could burn through it in a morning. I did not do so. Eve, how far into Happy Jail did you get?
2 episodes and maybe a little bit of the third, and then it wasn't like I flounced away in a huff or anything like
right,
that. Like, it wasn't like, whatever. Like, I'm turning this off because they killed the dog or anything. And I was interested. Like, when I was watching it, I liked that it was half an hour. I was interested during it, but not interested enough that I felt the itch to go back to it when I was interrupted.
Yeah, that's about where I was. Like, I came to a stopping point at the end of episode 2, and I'm like, I think I have enough of an idea to give listeners an idea of whether they should listen to it. Basically, this is the jail that, if you remember the Michael Jackson's Thriller viral dance video from a decade ago now, I think, more. This is that jail. It's the Cebu Provincial Detention Center, or something like that. That it's a much longer name, and I think we'll hear about it in a terrible song in a later clip that can correct me. it's about this jail, which is like actually a lot of other stories, each of which, if they'd selected a single strand, could be the focus of a single feature documentary or series. There's the fact that this dude, Marco, is now sort of the commandant of this prison in which he used to live. There's the fact that President Duterte, I never know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Well, neither of us are well-versed in Tagalog, so we just have to do the best we can here, I think.
All right. So the president of the Philippines has made repeated statements about, you know, draconian responses to drug possession, use, and particularly distribution that he wants to enact. We'll hear a clip about that later. There is the dancing inmates of this jail. There is the fact that LGBTQ plus prisoners at this jail are accorded elevated status thanks to their relationship with the dancing inmates squad, which does not necessarily accord with how they're treated outside all the time, or would be in any other prison. There are about a billion different directions that you could go with this series. And I felt like while they were getting good interviews and it was, you know, compelling to look at, like, it's not bad and it's not badly made, but given that it's trying to do everything, it's doing it too slowly, in my opinion. What did you think of the pacing?
Well, I mean, I just thought the whole thing was a freaking mess. Like, I'm not arguing for creating an artificial storyline, you know, like, you know, on Top Chef or something where it's like, oh, he was bad at the beginning and now he made a good duck or whatever. But that I felt like there was little to no effort made by the people making this series to organize this into cogent narratives or to tell a story. And I think that that is probably the primary reason that I didn't feel compelled to continue, because I felt like it's one of those things like when you start watching a show and then they cancel it midway or something and you just say, well, you know, I'm enjoying this, but I'm not going to watch the rest because I know I'm never going to find out like who the killer was or whatever.
Right.
And I sort of felt the same thing. Like, they would pick up a thread. Like, exactly. You know, about, I think the guy, the choreographer who comes into the jail to do this stuff, I think his name was Ray. I could be wrong about this. You know, and it was sort of like, ah, you know, this is Ray. And, you know, Ray has these sort of ideas of how this goes. And, oh, I thought Ray was gay, but Ray's not gay and all that. Like, and, you know, are we going to hear more about Ray? What's going to happen? And then we, you know, it wasn't picked up. All of the stuff about people who... some of these people who describe themselves as gay or ladyboys, we in the outside in the U.S. would probably refer to them as transgender. Some of these people do seem to identify as female in a certain sense. And sort of parsing how all that works, because God forgive me, even as a person who's pretty familiar with sort of corrections and how all this works, my, sort of biggest touchstone on all these guys was that character in Con Air. And if there's anybody who's listening who knows what I'm talking about, you know I'm right. The character who played a sort of female-identifying convict in that movie, too. I know it's a thing, but I, you know, explaining that, giving us some understanding, I would have accepted a voiceover that helps explain what's happening just fine. All of the stuff about drugs in the prison, all the stuff about how the, you know, how Marco was just like, oh, give up your weapons. All the overcrowding, there were so many, so many stories that we were spoiled for choice. But it was just sort of like, you know, the purse was just dumped out on the table.
Yes, that's the perfect way to put it. As you were talking, I was thinking of other storylines, including like that visiting day is like a camp out overnight in the courtyard, and that he's like, you know, this makes the most sense. Da, da, da. Okay. Like, yeah, it does, as long as you could sort of keep order. But there's also like an entire guard economy involving contraband. And this is why they take the job, is so that they can make the extra money from.
How about how there are women in the jail? That there are women in the jail that are jammed into, like, that there are, what is it, 200 women jammed into six cells, and how you're not allowed to leave the cell for a month, which made me think of, like, you know, Orange is the New Black, how you have to wear, like, the one color scrubs at first. And I mean, there are a million stories that I would have happily watched, you know, a feature-length doc. By feature-length, I mean, like, an hour and a half, guys, not Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I would have happily watched a feature-length doc on any of these, the whole thing, because, you know, the election stuff.
Yeah, one of the women that they interview repeatedly is, you know, she's married to someone who was in the jail and now works there. Or is he still a prisoner?
No, I think he's like, you know, not to jump ahead, I think he's like the Big Black, which is the name of a character, a name of a person. I think he's like, that guy is like the Big Black of
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they have like trustees. They call it something else, but they have trustees, and I think he's a trustee. Well,
I'm glad that you brought that up, the trustee thing, because that was the name of one of my favorite dogs, but also because... So who is the audience that this is intended for? Is it intended for American audiences, or was this something that was on Filipino TV? I couldn't really figure that out in my research. Do you have any insight into that?
I don't. And I'd like, this is another problem, like going back to what you were saying about inmates who may identify as transgender or may only, you know, feel that they're doing drag, like the terms that they use are for us antiquated, but it's unclear whether that's like a bad, sort of like difficult translation, or there are distinctions in Filipino culture, or there are distinctions in Filipino prison culture. Like, we needed a better, like, I don't know, framework or voiceover or something that's like, you know, these terms that we're used to thinking of in X way are actually used in Y way.
Exactly. And across like everything to do with prison, because everybody, like, if we use the example of the show that you and I both wrote about, you know, for other sites, 60 Days In, you know, everybody who's watching this show has probably watched a show, an actual like show that takes place in an American prison. We all have a pretty solid idea of how it works. And so saying, like, you know, while American prison is like this, here in this prison, everybody sleeps in a hammock and gets to wear clothes from Forever 21 or whatever, you know, like, but the thing is, I don't want to put myself at the center of all this. If this is a show that was like a show that was aired in the Philippines or something like that, then it's a whole different ballgame, and my criticisms are sort of selfish and moot, but that, you know, that there isn't sort of any contextualization of what this show is for or what it's about or whatever, you know, sort of hobbles it.
Yeah. Well, and it's one thing if, like, the producers felt like, well, you know, if you're interested in how things work differently, you can look it up. But, like, there are enough parallels between like Filipino and American jails, and this is a jail, not a prison.
Right.
So a lot of these people were put in on whatever drug charges or petty theft, or were framed by the cops. They allege, who knows? These claims are not interrogated. Marco's claims about anything are, from what we saw, not interrogated. So that's a problem. But this is a jail where, you know, 80% of the population is supposed to be there temporarily, and then they're there for a decade and a half. It's a huge, like, just criminalization of drug possession and addiction. You know, oh, not something we're dealing with here. Like, even the United States is trying to come up with alternate methods of dealing with this problem instead of criminalizing it, because there's just nowhere to put everyone. Thanks.
And then there's a cycle of addiction inside the prison.
Yeah.
It seems like this, you know, I'm saying all of these things with this sort of, you know, I keep upspeaking the end of my sentences, and I dislike that, especially on podcasts, but I feel like I have to keep upspeaking at the end because I'm not really given an answer by the show. Is there a cycle of addiction at the prison? It kind of sounds like it, because that one guy said there was, that there were drugs, and then everybody went off drugs. So, you know, but I'm saying all that not really sure what happened, because no one is saying this happened and then that happened. I mean, I'm not saying that everything has to be wrapped up for me in a bow. It can be messy. It can be like, we don't know what's happening, and this is, you know, the court system here is jacked, and the, you know, the drug war is a mess or whatever. But I just wanted someone to really explain to me what was going on.
Yeah, this is a little bit too collage-y, and there's no like underpinning of information for this, you know, American viewer. Let's hear a clip, because this is one of the sort of intake officers talking about the percentage of these cases that are drug related. And then it's Duterte talking about his quote policy.
Every time there's a remand, it's always drugs.
My campaign against drugs will not stop until the end of my term, until the last pusher and the last drug lord are...
Have you heard the news? Yeah. If you are a drug lord and you will not stop, they will be killed.
Oh, Sarah, when that was just something other countries did, where they had leaders talking and sounding all wild like that? Those were the good old days.
Yeah. Weren't they? I mean, look, you sort of can't roll that footage and then not give us at least like a 60 to 90 second overview of where, as of when you shot this, the laws and statutes are. At least locally. Instead, they have sort of an extended series of talking heads with this guy who's like, he was arrested for possession. He spent like 15 years inside. He had 5 years out. Now he's back in. He's very philosophical about his drug use and taking responsibility for it. And he's very interesting. And if they had followed just him, and been like, and then in the, you know, all around him is, he happens to be in the jail with the dancing inmates, and he has two left feet, like your co-host, and like that would have been interesting. But instead of telling us exactly what brings so many people to this jail for this reason, they're sort of doing this more impressionistic thing, that while that guy has a way of putting things, it's not helping to locate us.
And it's fine. Like, I can Google all these statistics and figure out that, you know, the average sort of length of time
between
arrest and prosecution. Yeah, no, I shouldn't have to do that.
This is the point of a documentary. It's like, we did all this research so you can just sit here with your knitting and a cat in your lap and feel like you know fuck all. So, I resent having to do the work. Like, that's not actually true, but like, there are about half a dozen really interesting stories in here, but because, as you said, they dumped the purse out on the table, we're not exactly getting to any of them.
What about the kingpin? The kingpin who had people get his name tattooed on their body. And here's a question. Was that kingpin dancing with everybody else? That's what I want to know.
And did he come through with the promised
$100 bounty? He gave that one guy money. I mean, I didn't count it. I couldn't see it. It looked like good money, but what are you doing with all that cash? Who's walking around? See, I mean, who is stashing away cash in their hammock in this?
Well, I'm sure that he's like, oh, I'm being sent to this facility. Mm-hmm. Great. He has people inside and outside who know which guards he's supposed to talk to. Da 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 da. That may have all been explained in episode 3, but I was not at all confident that it would be. So I didn't continue to episode 3.
So when, when I was sitting there looking at, looking up statistics as opposed to actually looking at what was on my screen, one of the things I started to wonder, and so I pulled, the level of homelessness in, various cities in the Philippines is very high just because poverty is so grave. And so I started thinking, are people intentionally getting busted so they can go to jail where they are not going to experience food insecurity, and, they will have somewhere comfortable to be out of the rain, and people, if there is some sort of moral code or something where people aren't going to steal your $100 that you have stashed in your hammock, it's safer in a lot of ways. Like, is that what's going on? If you or I are downtown and we don't want to go back home, right? We go to a coffee shop and hang out until our next meeting. So to me, it seems like you know, it's all sort of a similar thing. But I am not unaware here in the States of homeless people who, now I've heard of people who attempt to go to jail so they can get health care. That's not just anecdotal. That is a true thing, but that's a whole other story that somebody should adapt.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, contrast this with something that you and I talked about on the Blotter Presents many, many moons ago, the Kalief Browder story. There is an acceptance from people being interviewed that they will get picked up on some sort of like middling charge, like some whatever class E something or other. Bail, I think, is not usually on the table as a consideration. They expect to spend years on end in this facility, and they seem not okay with it. I mean, actually, one guy seemed okay with it, but they seemed like, well, this is just how it is here.
Yeah.
I mean, here, even though like that is sort of SOP at Rikers and other, you know, and in other cities, it's there's much more of a light hung on it of late. But that's another aspect of this story that I think it would have been helpful to have a wild line in there that's like, you know, this is regularly the length of a detention for a minor charge, and people don't even think twice about it.
Yeah.
Let's hear from one of the lead dancers, Jeffon, who was just sort of trying. I was really looking forward to this being the beginning of a fuller explanation of the guard economy. It was not that, but this is sort of what you're dealing with in clip three.
In my first week here, I was really shocked because most of the guards are not after their salary. They're paid minimum. And then they get big pays from getting in the illegal things. So if you want illegal things to get inside, you need to go to the guards. And I said, oh my God, what a government.
This is, I think, my foundation issue with it, is that not only are there too many things going on, but they keep almost, but like, pulling it together and going in a cogent direction. It's like, okay, now we're going to focus on this aspect. The next clip is from episode two. The previous governor of the province's brother, I guess, was the some kind of commissioner. And the dancing was happening, and he was the guy who had the idea to film them. And then he talks about why, like, what inspired him about their dance core. And the scene that he references is something that I coincidentally just happened to dial past on basic cable last night. Let's hear clip four.
Byron thought of filming them and uploaded the dance routines. The rest was history.
Dancing inmates of CPDRC, fun and laughter, smiles in every corner. Cause we got moves, and now millions of viewers have watched us on YouTube.
CPDRC,
Alay Pasigarbo,
CPDRC.
The real reason why I introduced dancing, you know, movie I saw, it's called The Shawshank Redemption. An inmate barged into the warden's office and played an aria. The inmates were amazed. They suddenly stopped everything as if they were suspended in time.
To this day, I have no idea what those Italian ladies were singing about. I mean, first of all, that song is like, I just love how in the States that would be like, I don't even know, a PSA for not littering. That
like
music.
don't like just throw your electric scooter on the ground when you're done using it, lock it up in a bike rack. Yeah.
And like fun and smiles at every corner. I'm like, not every corner. And then he goes into his rationale talking about, and he calls it a Shawshank Redemption, which is a whole other conversation. I think that's a very different movie.
Also, right after that scene, I mean, doesn't Andy get the shit kicked out of him so badly? He's like, completely smashed and in the hole for like ages?
No, that is a later sequence. He does get 2 weeks in the hole. Byron has to break the window and get him out. You're mine now.
I knew this was one of your Poppy Field movies. I knew it had to be.
Yeah, I tweeted about it last night with that hashtag. At least as far as we watched, again, I don't think it's a bad idea to have, you know, I think trustees are a good idea if it's sort of a, you know, monitored situation. And I also don't think it's the worst idea to have former prisoners make up a large percentage of your at least consulting at a jail or prison.
Absolutely.
Because they can communicate to you the real issues with like basic human rights shit. And say, like, you know, it would go a long way if you would take such and such a measure. And then other places where you have to make cuts will go down a little easier, blah, blah, blah. Yes, that makes perfect sense. But we also see Marco like rousting homeless people living under overpasses to try to find a TV that was stolen from him. And as far as we saw, his role and his like the amount of power that he's currently wielding is not really interrogated by the film. And you also don't get any like framework or perspective on how participation may have been premised on an positive, like optimistic, cheerleader adjacent portrayal of the setup. Does that make any sense?
It makes sense. I mean, I have to say, and this is, you know, this is not Marco's fault, but there's something about Marco that gave me what my husband and I refer to as the big tail. There's something about Marco. I get an animal ick, like an animal discomfort when he talks and when I look at him. If Gavin De Becker were here, he would refer to it as the gift of fear. Mm-hmm. There is something about him. I mean, I'm a 48-year-old lady and I have not made it this far in my life in, you know, driving across country regularly and in a big city without listening to that animal ick. And when I get it from people, I'm not magic or anything. And I, you know, this is not a reason to send Marco to jail, but I'm just saying there's something about him that concerns me gravely. And I have a hard time believing, given how strong my reaction was, that other people don't feel the same way.
I didn't get the,
yeah,
the big null.
so you love Marco and he's your boyfriend now?
No, there's a, you know, there's a gray area here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just think that we're being shown this very sort of like hail, positive, press for, you know, for public consumption sliver of what he's about and his day. And that this documentary in places seems like the happy jail was like, sure, you can have access, but you need to spout the party line and it needs to be called happy jail. Like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, but I'd say, yeah, sure. And I would do all that. And then once I had the footage, I would come back, I would call it happy jail. And I would, like, once again, I hate to keep bringing up 60 Days In because it's not a good show. It's not a good show, Sarah, but the thing is, if you or I had to write down sort of the storylines and, you know, the A, B, C, D, what happened with people besides our main people who, you know, were sort of in there just to learn about jail, we could. There was, you know, every week we'd sort of see like, okay, on today, this week on 60 Days In, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. And I don't know, I hate to sort of indict something for disorganization, but I kind of have to. And
yeah.
Yeah.
No, same. The last clip is from, I believe his name is actually Vince.
Oh, thank you. Where did I get Ray?
I don't know. One syllable. That he's talking about the fact that when he's choosing sort of instruction lieutenants, he has to pick people who are in there for serious crimes because everyone else is short term in theory. And then Jafon is back talking about how trans and LGBTQ plus prisoners can gain status. It's implied from being in the dancing inmates and being in leadership positions and that, but I think there's more to that story too.
Yep.
Just one of many times where it was like, okay, here's our, you know, topic sentence. And then the paragraph following that was supposed to elaborate kind of never came. Here's clip 5.
All of the people in the dancing inmates in the CPDRC are come and go. So I train you now, then tomorrow you're gone. The lead dancers, I pick them as big case, double murder. If you pick only a thief, by maybe 1 week, he will gone. The gays are my backup. The gay inside is, it's like a queen of the jail.
My name is Marvin and I'm from Asturias. I am a makeup artist outside. I love so much the awesome man. I am gay. Like, yes.
I'm a cross-dresser, so I don't have really a boy's outfit outside, except here, because I'm wearing orange.
I love that guy.
Mm-hmm, me too.
He'll just sort of like start laughing at the fucked upness of his situation. There's so much more I want to know, and I don't think it's actually in Happy Jail. I mean,
what happened to that kitten, Sarah? What happened to him?
Oh my God, the kitten was fine. Yeah. Trainspotting reference, folks. Jeez, I'm old. If you guys have watched further and it sort of like coheres around anything that we've talked about, let us know. Once again, Blotter Presents Across Social. I'm not going to not recommend it, but I will say, like, if you're sort of at the end of the first episode and you turn to your TV watching partner and or pet and you're like, should I keep going with this? Let your tastes guide you. If you're sort of like, I don't regret watching that, but there's other stuff on, I totally get it. But if you really were struck or compelled by this and you think we're way off base, we'd also love to hear from you and you can talk about why. Eve, your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I completely agree. And I think the fact that each episode, you know, clocks in at under half an hour makes it like sort of a good thing. Like when you're like, maybe like you're waiting for somebody to show up or, you know, food to be delivered or, you know, you're just killing like a little bit of time and you want something that's going to keep your brain off everything else. This is not a bad option.
Yeah. And I don't think you even have to watch it in order, honestly. Like if one episode, like episode 4, you're like, that looks interesting, just start there, because this is sort of like the silver lining of the disorganization.
Yeah.
Is that you can kind of start anywhere. Not so much with our cold case. Documentary Ghosts of Attica from Icarus Films. Here's the case file from Amazon's product page. Attica. Oh my God, this is so overwritten. Anyway, Attica. Like Watergate and Vietnam, it is an icon of recent history. Governor Rockefeller's brutal retaking of the prison, a 9-minute, 1,600-bullet assault that took the lives of 29 inmates and 10 guards held hostage, put an end to the 4-day rebellion, but the struggles for justice by both prisoners and guards endured for 3 decades. Ellipsis. Ghosts of Attica offers a definitive account of America's most violent prison rebellion, its suppression, and the days of torture that ensued, using exclusive images, documents, and interviews. More than just a history film, it also chronicles an unfolding contemporary story as both inmates and guards united by suffering, but divided by race, class, and culture, hurtle towards a final showdown with the state. End quote. This is, as we record this, actually the 48th anniversary of the beginning of the Attica Uprising, which started September 9, 1971. We're talking about it because I got a PR blast about the film, along with the screener link, and I assumed it was new content. It took me a second to realize, A, this actually belonged in the cold case section and not Most Wanted because it came out in 2001, and B, that I'd actually seen it before. What tipped me to both was B-roll of the diner, where the inmate's sort of lead class action attorney, Linda Fink, gets her mail delivered, the St. Clair, RIP, on the corner of Smith and Atlantic in Brooklyn. I ate many a hangover omelet in and from that joint back at the turn of the millennium. And it's located a few blocks from the court complex in the borough, near the jail and a bunch of law school bars. It is gone now. The fortress of law enforcement it used to sell danishes to has only expanded. I liked this pretty well. I don't think I understand why we're rehearing about it now. I had a couple of little issues with it, but overall it's like a very sort of no frills, pretty much what you'd expect. Look at the aftermath, like what happened at Attica, the aftermath for both guards and prisoners, and the fact that they sort of start the story like resenting one another for trying to get justice from the state for basically like shooting fish in a barrel in order to make a point. But then, you know, maybe not realizing, but it becomes clear, at least to the viewer, that they're actually on the same side. What did you think of this one?
Well, I think that this is, you know, if I were teaching a sort of like a 101 level or, you know, advanced high school class on the correction system, on, you know, I don't know, gosh, even like a good unit on like the sort of the grown-up version of New York history or something like that. I think that this would be a great documentary to show kids, because I feel like not only does it explain the, you know, the actual events in a pretty clear-eyed way, it's, you know, it's not like, even, you know, we'll get to the narrator in a second, even though it's obviously coming at it from a criminal justice reform standpoint and in my opinion, it's a, you know, it's pretty unbiased and pretty centered, but I'm sure that more Law and Order types would describe this as a lefty film. It's not really, though. I mean, if it's to the left, it's like, I don't know, not that far to the left, right? Like maybe a centimeter to the left.
Yeah, I don't think that the law enforcement people involved / interviewed here.
Oh, well, yeah, I definitely want to discuss that, but I'm just saying that this is a good unbiased thing that you could show children who are capable of seeing some very graphic photos, which there are at the end of the scene.
Yeah.
Older high school, like, you know, high school kids that are like in the AP class or something like that. Like I would, were I an educator or someone who was homeschooling, you know, mature kids or someone who was teaching like a freshman college class, I would happily show this to people. I think that the pacing is still very solid, even though this movie is almost 20 years old. And as a side note, I'll also mention a fun fact. A fun fact about a horrible massacre. A fun fact is not only is like today, you know, today is the anniversary, the day that we're recording this, so September 9th, 1971, but the civil action began at 420, and many people believe that that is one of the origins of 420, is the day to smoke marijuana as sort of a symbol of whatever, and, you know, film conspiracists, you know, will know that in Pulp Fiction, there are all those clocks set to 420 there in the place where Zed is when Ving Rhames is being held hostage. And many people say that that's because Quentin Tarantino always wanted Ving Rhames to play Big Black, which I know that it seems like every time we do this podcast, I talk about Ving Rhames. But I mean, when you're just like listening to this, aren't you like Ving Rhames and Rosie O'Donnell? Where are you playing these roles, right?
Well, our first clip is actually from, you hear from a few of the guards / hostages who are initially not pleased that the inmates have persevered, and they really had to persevere. Like, I mean, how many juries were like, yes, you deserve compensation, and then the state always found a way to send it back or overturn it. But certainly law enforcement was not thrilled. And argued that they also should be compensated, which fucking A, they should have, because when the shooting started, you know, nobody cared who got killed. They were trying to make a point, knowing they could blame it on the prisoners. Anyway, Here's how you could tell that this sequence is from a law enforcement perspective. Bagpipes.
When I first heard about the settlement, it really pissed me off. These are the guys that started the riot, did all the damage, and they're getting paid.
We should not have to pay them $8 million. Fine, some of them got hurt. Fine, some of them got shot. We had a lot of our people get shot.
Everyone thinks that it is time that the hostages and their families receive some type of consideration.
The inmates got their money? Fine. Now give me mine.
I mean, I think that's legitimate, and frankly, I think people on the prisoner side of the aisle would agree.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Basically everyone present got screwed over, so... And, you know, sometimes paying for it with their lives. So that was, but that was sort of an interesting, like, place to start from, I thought, for the movie. And you have so many people who were there. You have a New York Times writer and, like, official observer at the time, Tom Wicker, who we'll hear from him in a second. You have guards, you have inmates, and... It's an interesting choice to sort of start from this, like, friction over trying to get the state to admit, like, take some monetary responsibility, and then you go back to the events as they occurred, and that's when it becomes clear, not just to the audience, but I think to some of the participants, like, oh, that we are actually on the same side here. So that was an interesting choice. Also, interesting's not really the word. Susan Sarandon is ostensibly the narrator here, but she's, like, barely in it, and I don't think she's really needed.
Well, I'm putting my brain back to 2001, which does, you know, whatever. It's a whole person who can, you know, vote ago. She definitely, you know, was sort of a... not a figurehead, but, you know, she was someone who was outspoken about lefty causes. I guess back then she was still with Tim Robbins too, so I can see why she would have been attracted.
Shawshank, and also she was in Dead Man Walking, so.
Oh God, I forgot about that. So So she was outspoken about prison reform before she, you know, obviously her greatest crime now is her chain of ping pong bars. So the less said about those, the better. That's the only bad thing she's done the last few years, though, guys. Everything else is cool.
Yeah.
But I can see where if we had been watching it at the time, and you probably, when you saw it back in the day, you probably didn't think about it. But now it's just like, even hearing her voice, I'm like, son of a bitch. Ping pong bars.
Well, and it's just like... I got this, like, documentary now vibe from it. It's like, this is who you would get to do, like, the parody version.
Well, see, this is a whole other conversation about how documentary now has changed our ability to perceive certain things that are, you know, very, very tropey, which this show, I mean, once again, this is 18 years old, but this thing, you know, in a lot of ways follows all of the beats of a documentary very well. And documentary now has made that more difficult for me. Like, I am always waiting for the punchline now.
Yeah, kind of. But then I also feel this is something that I sort of struggle with on this podcast is like, you know, when I say that something follows predictable beats and is put together competently, like that's fine. Like, you don't really need to, like, we have a Frederick Wiseman and that's fine. Like, you don't have to Errol Morris every shot. We don't need, like, crazy, I don't know, like, I just...
You don't have to put a bird on it, guys. It's fine. Just,
you know, you don't.
A workman, this was, when you say it's like, this is a workman-like documentary, all of that does sound like we're marginalizing it, but we're not.
Yeah, we're not. Like, it's an hour and a half. It's not trying to be a series. It's not trying to be Shoah. It's just like, here's what happened. Here are the interviews.
Yeah.
And we're out because what they were probably trying to do... I feel like I must have seen this because I have, like, every possible airing of that PBS show POV,
mm-hmm.
like, set. And I must have seen, but the IMDb does not back me up on where I might have seen it. Who knows? Like,
could you have gone to like a film festival or something? This feels very documentary film festival to me.
It could also have been sometimes Channel 13, which is our it's like the flagship PBS here, and they'll just put movies on, and it's like, you know, a late night documentary hour. And so I could have gotten it that way. I could have gotten it from Netflix back when they sent me like 5 DVDs a month. I'm old. Actually, I wanted to play a clip from Tom Wicker because this was one of the most concise arguments for prison reform and sort of for like making civilians who are like, lock them all up, go to a prison for 10 minutes and try to understand it as a human being.
I'm absolutely convinced if the general public saw what happens in prisons and the conditions that people live in, you wouldn't have anything like the overwhelming approval of prisons that you do have in this country, because they're terrible places. They are terrible places. You can't keep men confined in cages and expect them to come out of the cage better men than they were when they went in. I don't know why people think that that's going to be the case, but you can't. It won't work. You can't do it.
Yeah, pretty much. And I thought it was an interesting reflection of what Marco is saying in Happy Jail, which is like, you know, having been there, having done the time, I understand what prisoners think about and what they need, and I can use that to my advantage. So that was an interesting parallel between them.
Well, and even too, just like the difference between jail, which is where you are while you're awaiting trial, and you know, prison, which is where you go after you're sentenced. Just the differences in mindset there too are so dramatic, and with that comes like a difference in how those facilities are managed. You know, and I feel like all of that comes into play both in Happy Jail and, you know, in this show, because even though we hear that hardline law enforcement sort of stuff, like, well, we deserve the settlement too. Why did the inmates get this and we didn't? That is not the only sentiment that these guards turned hostages expressed. These people, and at first I was like, is this like Stockholm Syndrome? All of these guards like sort of expressed that, you know, later on that this, you know, that this rebellion was mishandled and that these guys had some decent points when it came to how they wanted to be treated while in prison. That was probably the biggest surprise to me as someone who was sort of superficially familiar with, you know, the history behind all this, that these guards are like, it was terrible how they came and how they shot everyone in the back. And I don't know. I thought that was like sort of the most interesting and surprising thing to me. And, you know, Wicker at the time, he was kind of like the pool reporter almost. Like, right. You know, he was the guy. So the pool reporter, you know, you guys know this, if you know about covering the White House. There's one reporter, because everybody can't be there all the time, who sort of writes stuff, and they have to write it like real straight, real like, this has happened and this happened and this happened, and then everybody else like picks it up, and that's where you get your wire reports and your local news reports and everything. So Wicker was like, not only was he, you know, writing this stuff for the Times instead of sending out a pool report, but he would do these addresses. I can't remember if they were daily or maybe like every other day or a couple of times a day, where he would be out and talk to, you know, all the other members of the media who were sort of waiting outside the gates. And it was almost like a press conference. Like, he'd say, this happened and this happened. And, there's some very brief footage in this film, and you can find other footage of it probably on YouTube, where you'll hear members of the media like reacting, you know, like, ah, you know, this and that, or applauding or whatever. It was very interesting seeing how the media as a whole sort of viewed this as a narrative, and how Wicker at the time, you could tell he was trying. This was sort of like, you know, the 70s were sort of when unbiased journalism really sort of hit its stride, as this idea that everyone's going to tell the story straight, even if you yourself think it's insane. And so you could see Wicker sort of struggling with that sometimes, because as he grew sort of more and more sympathetic to the folks inside the prison.
Yeah, there was also a sequence. I didn't pull a clip, but it's just like the pool outside responding to a press conference about Governor Rockefeller declining to attend this uprising.
Oh, God, that's right. Yeah, yeah, I forgot
and
about that.
And this Jerry dude who's like just using all this doublespeak, and there's not one person in the pool who is having it, and they basically like physically chased him off the podium, and he's like, that's all, bye. And they're like, are you fucking kidding? Like someone was like, yeah, you know, get the fuck out of it. It was funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't funny, but I was like, yeah, well done. Because seriously, like, don't be up there to Sarah Sandersing about this issue. But I guess we know where they learned that shit. Speaking of Governor Rockefeller, I think that he, to this day, enjoys a rather rosy reputation as like one of those harmless New York Republicans who's not really a Republican, and we can still like him, right? Because he's a, you know, he's a Rockefeller. I'm about to play a fairly long clip that is trying to put into context not just how politicians were thinking about law and order, but also how you know, a scion of the Rockefeller family was thinking about how he would interact with people of color, mainly that he wouldn't. Here's clip 8.
You have to remember, this is 1971. Nixon is in the White House, and this is at the heart of the whole law and order epidemic in this country. And I think Rockefeller had not at that point given up his presidential ambitions. And he wanted to be seen as tough and not as soft on crime.
We're talking about people's lives. And that's a grave enough situation that it deserves executive attention.
Sergeant Cunningham, now would you give us a message for Governor Nelson Rockefeller?
I certainly would. If he says no, I'm dead.
You know, Rockefeller's the man. We suggested on the phone that if the man came up there, then the man cared. He just felt somehow that it was beneath him, governor of a great state and the representative of a great family, to come up there and deal with murderers, rapists, and thieves. That somehow this would be the world turned upside down. The establishment just couldn't lower itself to do that kind of thing. Therefore, he wasn't going to come. He just wasn't going to come.
That is even an option, and that never mind that he thought it was an option, and like it was, he didn't go. He sent them like a taped message, right?
Yeah.
But that he would just be like, well, this is, you know, this is unseemly. Like, are you fucking kidding? Like, you're the governor of the state. Men technically employed by you are being held hostage, and the prisoners' demands include non-roach infested food, fresh water, and legal representation, which is not exactly like they're not asking you to drive a gold Rolls Royce up to the back and turn them all loose. They would just like to be treated like people. And you're like, nah, what? And that, you know, and that everyone was like, okay, well, the governor has spoken. Like, there wasn't one person who was like, bro, you have to fucking go down there.
Yeah.
Nope. And then, the solution was when the, you know, whatever fucking candy gram failed to just start shooting into the crowd and be like, well, we're not going to tolerate this. Like, there were so many other options and they were all better than this. And you picked this one. It's fucked up. And I thought that was a really well done, really well put together sequence.
Yeah.
Good, good talking head from Wicker, sort of interstitially. This documentary doesn't asterisk things too much, but it just makes sure you understand, like, here's what the problem is with this, and here's what's at stake at this juncture. So, yeah, I thought it was good. And I think that Linda Fink is... I mean, I wonder if anyone's written a book about her. I would read like an oral history by her of this legal process, like just when she's talking about how she decided to become a lawyer. And in our last clip, she's talking about how once again, the prisoners managed to get a judgment and they get a settlement. And she's talking about the difference between a victory in this action and justice in the situation in clip 9.
Who they were, a bunch of black, Puerto Rican, people of color, rebellious convicts, was more important to the system than the Constitution and the concept of justice. And so we did not get justice. No justice at all. No justice for anybody. So you ask, well, if there's no justice, why do we do this? And the answer to that is because there's a struggle for justice. And the struggle for justice is what makes this meaningful and what makes life meaningful.
I can't really do any better than that. Eve, any closing thoughts on this one?
You know, I think that, you know, if you do watch this now, and I think it's a, you know, I think it's a great idea to watch it and sort of get an overview. You know, something to know is that almost everybody that you're going to see on screen, you know, has since passed. You know, 1971 was the year I was born. It was a long ass time ago. you know, Miss Fink died, I don't know, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago, and a big black who also, you know, has a lot to say. He was sort of like the comms director for the prison at the time. He passed away in 2007.
I don't know how I managed to not have a clip with him in it, but oh my God, what a...
Oh, he's so charismatic.
Flavorful, charismatic. Yeah. He just has a way of putting things that's just like, it's absolutely sugar-free and it'll just stay with you. Yeah, he's great.
But Michael Smith, who is the very young guard who, you know, is completely recognizable in the old footage and then when he's talking in 2001, because he has barely aged, he's still around, he's still doing interviews. If you just Google Michael Smith Attica, you can find a lot of other video interviews he's done since. He did a lot of stuff, I think like the 40th anniversary of it all too, and he continues to be really outspoken on you know, corrections reform and all that. Kim Kardashian, he might be someone you'd want to talk to.
Yeah.
Kim Kardashian, who I know listens to this podcast.
Well, she'd better start.
She's only a free subscriber to Best Evidence. She doesn't pay, but...
Hey, look, it's a gateway drug, the free subscription. Yes, Ghosts of Attica is available on Amazon. You can rent it for $2 or $3. And I recommend it if you're looking for it's just a solidly made documentary that if you know nothing about Attica, it will take you through it and not over explain. There is some imagery that's going to be upsetting.
Yeah.
Eve, where else can listeners find you and your works and days? Speaking of Best Evidence.
I'm hopeful that everyone who's listening is a subscriber to Best Evidence. We don't expect you all to pay. We understand I don't have any money either. You know, Best Evidence is also a great gift to give people. And if you are a paid subscriber, you will get it 5 days a week as opposed to the 2 that you get it otherwise. And if we have 2,000 paid subscribers by next summer of 2020, then I will cover the Theranos trial from the courtroom in San Jose. You will get daily updates on it, original content from me. I'm actually a reporter, so it won't just be, you know, turtlenecks. So, you know, think about it. It's $5 a month or $55 a year.
I would pay $5 a month for turtlenecks.
Well, okay, Richie Rich over here.
Yeah,
for everybody else, you'll actually get my typing too. So, so please consider reading, subscribing to and reading Best Evidence. You can always get started for free and up it from there.
Yeah, agree. And don't forget, 3,000 paid subscribers means I fly out there.
Yep.
And take the pictures. I don't know what I do.
No,
am I your intern?
What you'll do, you're gonna come, you're gonna sleep on my couch. Here's the thing, my cat owns the couch now. So you're gonna have to hang out with my cat, who's a real pain in the ass. But you know, and then you'll come and I don't know, we'll tag team it. We'll figure it out.
All right.
It'll be good.
Cats hogging an entire couch, not a situation I'm unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, it's Murder in the Bayou, and we're talking about an Herbalife doc with new guest Dr. Marcia Chatelain, whose name I probably mispronounced. She'll be here next week to correct me. After that, unclear. ID's dropping a bunch of stuff, and I'm going to pick the garbagiest one and make Toby come down from the roof and talk about it with me. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents, on Facebook, Twitter, and Insta, and at Eve's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence, bestevidence.fyi. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you could tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find us. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you could keep that to yourself. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.